you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 8, Episode 9. We have Zach back in the studio with us this week.
Hey, guys.
He's done with his wife's birthday honey-do list from last week. I suppose we'll forgive you for leaving us.
I appreciate that.
Without you for a week. And, of course, Mike's joining us, as always.
Yo.
Yo, he says. I like it. I dig it.
Why not?
Let's go with yo. Today, we are discussing Episode 9. In this episode, there were kind of three areas of discussion. One was the handwritten notes of Detective Hardy, where a few things were revealed. We moved on to listener Julie Hahn, who came on and discussed the surveillance footage and security systems at Target in the early 2000s. And then we ended up with a computer forensic analysis report. So we've got a lot of listener questions. So right after a short break, we're going to go ahead and get started.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So real quick, before we get into questions, Mike ran them through for me, and there's a couple of things that we discussed today that aren't covered in the questions. One is nobody seemed to catch or didn't comment about it, but the bank records, I thought that was pretty interesting. When we looked through the handwritten notes, they appear to, it's hard to tell with the redactions, but the way I was reading it, it looked like Hardy did in fact, we know for a fact he did in fact request Deborah and Paul Perringer's cell phone numbers, the phone records for those. And all we have in the report is Paul's work number. So we're going to look even further into that and see if there were any cell phone records actually recovered for Deb. Because another thing that we could use from that is location data. You know, if they're outgoing calls, then, you know, we've learned from the Anand Syed case that you can't use the location data with any amount of accuracy on incoming calls. But for example, she says she called the tree service. If she had a cell phone and called the tree service, that will give us an accurate location as to where she was at when she did that. So we're going to keep pushing forward, working with Allison and with the Fort Worth PD and my upcoming trip to try to see if we can track that down. And also there was another discrepancy that nobody asked questions about on the report was the timing difference with Emilio Villa Gomez Gutierrez, where in the handwritten notes, it says that, you know, that Hardy was made aware that Officer LeBlanc had pulled over Emilio, thought he fit the description, and then it wasn't until a month later when he actually spoke to him. There's also quite a bit left out of the report. The main report that was in the notes, like the presence of Hugo, doesn't mention that the address that Emilio gave was not the actual address as to where he lived. I did say something about the last name differences, and I had a couple people reach out and say that's, how do they put it? Sometimes in the Latin community, you have your last name and then your mother's maiden name or your mother's last name. So like his last name, his surname would be Villa Gomez, and Gutierrez would be his mother's maiden name. So it wasn't necessarily that he gave the wrong information there. That I guess, real quick, those are a couple topics that I just wanted to at least touch on, that mention that we covered them this week that might jog anybody's memory. And then, Zach, what did you, I've talked to you in a couple weeks, but what did you think about the episode
Well, talking about the Emilio thing, the one thing that I possibly thought of, and maybe it's nothing, but in the Melgar case, there was an instance where they tried to talk to the housekeeper. I believe it was the housekeeper or mm-hmm. the girlfriend, and it was they talked to a totally different person that had the same name.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I don't remember the details, but I do remember.
But remember, there was an incident where it was a younger woman they were supposed to be talking to, and they talked to an older woman,
right?
But it had the same name. So I almost wonder if this was with the address discrepancy. If this was a similar thing where they pulled over this one Emilio, he gave them the address, and then when they tracked down Emilio, they found a different Emilio Villagomez.
Well, so interestingly, the way they tracked him down was not by his name.
Okay.
And some stuff we're going to get into a little bit this week, but they actually tracked him down by his vehicle.
Okay. So that's probably not the same, or it probably is the same person then.
Right. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure. Well, yeah, because when he talked to him, remember, he said, I did get the tickets that day. He said he got the tickets, but he lost them. He put them through the wash or something.
It just struck me when I was thinking about this with the Melgar case, how that happened in the Melgar case.
Mm-hmm. It just, to me, not to say that I would even say that, Emilio is a suspect. I mean, we don't really know much about him at all. But just, I guess, as a person of interest, somebody who comes up, it's just interesting the way, first of all, that he wasn't really pursued that much or at all. There's only the one conversation. The fact that we don't have any record of Hardy even attempting to get an alibi from him, ask him where he was at that day. It doesn't say that he ever even asked him. It doesn't say that he called his work. That Hugo was left out of the report is weird. It's interesting. And then when you look through the file, some listeners pointed me out, and again, this is stuff we're going to talk about this week. But a few listeners noticed some things in the reports that I hadn't connected the dots on. And so one of those things is they're looking for this car. They're looking for this 91 Lincoln. But there's nothing in those entries in the report that say we're looking for Emilio Villagomez's car. And so I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves there. But the car thing is interesting. I actually found something else in my files about Emilio too that just make the whole situation around him is odd, and it's just interesting that there was no attempt to really investigate him at all.
So do we know anything about his background as far as like if he had any criminal background that would push him to this case?
From what I've been able to find and from listener Don McElhaney, who's done some background checks as well, I don't see that he has any prior criminal record. If I remember correctly, there is some offense later. It's nothing violent, anything like this, but it doesn't look like the guy's got a record.
Okay. Because I was just trying to think of how the note would come into play with him.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, the note definitely wouldn't. So the issue with him as a suspect is, that's why I said I wouldn't even consider him a suspect, but definitely a person of interest that I'm curious about is if he were involved, he obviously would have to know something. It would be for a personal reason. Doesn't look like anything was of substantial value was stolen. The attack to me looks personal. And with the note, he would obviously have to know that Lloyd was a former cop. So there would have to be some connection there that we're unaware of for him to really be a viable suspect.
And the only other thing that came to mind through this episode was the discussion about the font of the letter. But I know there's some listener questions, so we can get into that when we get there.
Yeah, I think that's covered coming up here.
All right, our first question comes from Donna. Is it possible that the font on the note in question is set to default and it was Agnes who changed it whenever she typed a document but didn't have the know-how to change the default settings?
See, she brings up a really good point because that's actually my first point. I know in the episode you actually misspoke a little bit, and I don't know if you caught that, or I know I caught it after looking. You said that the note was sans serif and that the other letters had the serif, and it's the opposite way.
Okay.
The note has the serifs, the little feet.
Okay.
Which, in my eyes, plays totally different than if it was the other way around.
Okay.
Because a lot of times, that font does appear to be Times New Roman, which is typically a default font.
Uh-huh.
And
which one is Times New Roman?
The font that is on the letter that was in Lloyd's leg.
Okay, that's Times New Roman.
Yes, with the little feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a background on this. I actually did design work before I started tattooing. So I do, this does ring a bell to me.
Uh-huh.
Where that would be a normal default lettering, especially at that time frame.
Okay, because now it's usually that, is it Courier?
It's usually Arial.
Arial, yeah.
Courier is through is usually like a notepad.
Looks like
font.
A typewriter.
It looks like a typewriter font. Right. But Arial is typically like the new Microsoft Word. But I would say at that time, Times New Roman was a big one.
Okay.
And that appears to be Times New Roman to me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's a default setting. And that maybe Agnes did change the fonts on her other letters.
Yeah. So, Janaea, the one that caught this originally, had messaged me and said that, you know, kind of basically what you said, not about the which was which, but she's like, oh, I was looking at that differently. Like, Agnes must change the font, and then whoever did this didn't, you know, meaning that was the default. But then through our discussion, we looked, because you know, I told her, like, what are the, because they're very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like she's, you know, if Agnes was doing that, she's changing a font every time she types something in order to change it. So almost unnoticeable to almost unnoticeably different font. You know, it's not like she's changing it to like a script font or something like that. So like, why go through the trouble of doing that when you type something?
But do we know that? So the only thing that I've seen is that one.
That was the other thing that she clarified. I misunderstood her post to say that all of them. And she said, no, she said, to be fair, there's multiple letters. But you could only really see
the
font on the top one. And it's one that we know for a fact that Agnes typed. You can tell by the context
Which could just be an accident that you changed the font.
Right. Yeah, I mean, certainly there are many possibilities. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I think they're all equally probable. I don't think there's any way to narrow it down. To me, it seems unlikely that if Agnes is going to type out that letter, that she types the letter and says, oh, I want to change this to a font that is almost exactly the same as the default, but it's very, very slightly different. And then I mentioned to Janaea when we were talking, she said, that, you know, she's like, well, yeah, but I don't think she'd have the technical know-how to change the default. And I told her, I had an eMachines Windows PC at that time in my bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, I had a little apartment. And I didn't have any technical, computers were a new thing for me back then, but I remember changing the font to whatever I wanted. And it was like, just, you just clicked a box that said default. And then she went and checked and found out that is the case. So it's not like when you change a font in that version of Word back then, it was, it's actually more difficult now to change your default setting. But so that's just food for thought on the font thing. Again, I don't disagree with you that it, you know, if the Times New Roman was the default, and Agnes changed it, then that would be an indicator that was printed there.
Well, see, and the reason I brought this up is because it was misspoken the episode.
Okay.
And not to say it on you, but I feel like if it was the way that it was spoken in the episode, where the note did not match what she had typed previously, then that means the person would have had to change it.
Okay, so that is the case, because I'm kind of getting confused here too. So we know that the note on the leg was a different font than the note.
Correct.
Print.
Yeah. Yes.
So either one of two things happen. Either, and I think these are the two possibilities. Agnes, when she types a letter or typed that letter, went in and changed the font off from the default to her preferred font, which is almost the same, and printed it out. And then the killer printed it out, which again would have to be Deborah. It's 10 in the morning. If it was printed at 10 in the morning, you know, Deborah was there around then. We don't know exactly when she got there. And Lloyd was home too. But if she's the one that printed it, then if Agnes always changed the font for hers, then the leg note would be printed in the default font, and that's why it would be different. And the other option is that Agnes has changed the default font. So all the stuff she prints, which again, so just for everybody to know, I'm hoping to get a better look at the evidence. One thing that's very frustrating for me right now in reading this, I almost wish we had Maurice back, because at least he took 900 pictures at the crime scene. Because, you know, a lot of people have said, well, if Lloyd printed something that morning, then where is it? Which is a great question.
That is my question too. I was going to get to that. Is somebody printed something at 10 o'clock, regardless if it was Deborah or Lloyd or a third person that was the killer, somebody printed something.
Right.
Where is that document?
Right.
Because it couldn't have been Agnes. And we know the other letter was typed by Agnes.
Right. Yeah. That's not it. And also, it was only a 4-minute time span. So it wasn't that long list. Yeah. Something quickly was typed up and printed out while Agnes wasn't home. And people have said, well, where is it? Good question. But what we can't assume is that it's not there because nothing's documented.
Yeah.
Was there a trash can next to the computer desk? I bet there was. Was there anything in the trash can? Was there an inventory? When you know you have, it's frustrating because you know you have, as soon as you see this note on the leg, and there's a computer and printer in the house, you'd think that the CSI would be thinking, okay, this is something potentially we need to know, and start documenting and photographing every single piece of paper in that house. Mm. We don't have that. So the note could have been sitting on the desk underneath the computer after it was, or on the ground underneath the computer after it was knocked down. We wouldn't know because we don't have a photo of it and it wasn't documented.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. There's just a lot of possibilities. Personally, I don't think that it, and this is just 100% just my personal opinion. This is not, you know, there's no evidence, I think, to sway it one way or the other. In my opinion, it seems less likely to me that Agnes, when she goes to type a letter, changes the font. Again, because it's not like, you know, back then, you remember changing fonts and stuff like that was kind of a new deal.
Mm-hmm.
Remember an email, you could do it and people would send you an email like, why are their letters blue and pretty?
Comic Sans.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But so if it was something like that, sure. But it's like, we go print a letter, change the font to an almost identical font, and then let it go back to default. I think it's more likely that either that was the one she printed on was the default font, or that she liked that one better and had changed it to the default font. That to me seems more likely than her changing it. But again, that's just my opinion. But you know, all we really know is that something that took less than 4 minutes to type was typed up mm-hmm. at 9:57, starting at 9:57 in the morning, and then printed at 10:01 a.m. 4 minutes later.
Yeah, the one thing, and you've seen the log, I haven't seen it, is if any other word processing documents have been opened recently. And I don't mean that morning, but I mean like maybe she uses a different word processing app. You know what I mean? Like there was Notepad at that time. There was other things.
Somebody
know.
Mentioned that, and I believe in the log there's notation of her opening up the day before.
Okay.
Like opening up her Word documents. Like she had like open letter to God.
Because I think that would that would help this a lot too to figure out the font.
Well, I think that one thing that needs to be done is a computer forensic analysis now. Because another thing that gets pointed out, and I know we have a question about this here coming up, but Richard Plunkett, listener, noticed, and I saw it, but I, you know, you got to remember when I'm reading these documents and trying to write an episode, I can't get sucked into every rabbit hole. But one of the rabbit holes is that computer forensic report is missing a page. When it lists the activity for the day, the list starts with number 2. So where's number? We don't know what happened before that. So we don't exactly know, but I know that it does list activity from the day before. But you know, something that could be very easily done would be for them to open up that computer and the hard drive and look and see what was the default type font for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are things that could be done. I find it really difficult to believe that they weren't able to prove or disprove if it came from that printer. I've been told that, you know, I think he says in report or in his testimony, which I forgot to post, which I'm getting up. I got the report up and not his testimony. That it's, you know, the print, the paper, the Lloyd's leg note was consistent with an inkjet printer,
mm-hmm.
is all he said. But I've always been told that there's like almost like a fingerprint with those printers. And there's another cache or storage in the printer itself that should tell you what document was printed there. And I just don't know why that stuff wasn't. And to me, that's another miss on the defense. You know, as Dr. Amber said, they should have had a DNA expert. They should have had a computer expert too.
Yeah, and I don't care how you feel, whether guilt or innocent of Deborah. I'm taking Deborah totally out of this equation.
Right. Yeah.
I just want to know what happened at that point because if it is Lloyd, then it's presumably nothing. You know, it could have been anything. But if it wasn't Lloyd and it was the killer, then somebody's in that house for a long time.
Yeah. In my opinion, if that note was printed from that. If that note was printed in the house at 10 in the morning, then Deb's guilty. No question. To me, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
Or at least involved, mm-hmm. you know, some way or another. Because she's the only person that we know
would have been there. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was about 10:15 when Mabel across the street saw Deb, you know, walking. She was there around 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know what time. It seems like from all the different, if you piece together all the witness statements, and I have written to Deb finally, and I have enough questions for her that I wrote to her. I'm waiting to hear back
mm-hmm.
about her day. And one thing I asked for clarification on is her morning, because it seems from the witness statements that she did arrive there around 8 or 8:30, leave, and then come back again around 10. So she may not have even been there yet at 10. I think she was there at 10:15,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it could have been 10:05, 10:10. You know, we don't have any witness sightings saying her car was there at 10 for sure.
you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
I think there's a lot of things that could be answered, and I'm going to push for IPTX to, you know, with Allison to see, you know, let's see if we can get a more detailed, thorough computer forensic analysis could solve the case, you know, and it could. Now, if we find out that the note wasn't printed on that computer, which again, 100% just my opinion, I don't think that it was. It just doesn't make sense. There's too many things in my mind, and that's just my pea brain just spitballing, but it doesn't make sense that note, that you're looking at a crime that looks like it was just, you know, an explosion of anger, that anyone would like premeditate the note, but then it couldn't have been. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me. But anyway,
oh, Colleen Barnett,
right? And that doesn't make sense. But anyway, if the note wasn't printed there, that doesn't mean Deborah didn't do it, is what I'm getting at. But if the note was printed there at 10 o'clock in the morning, then I think that's really strong evidence that she did.
I'm not saying anything, but it's damn near, it's really hard to explain a short letter being typed and printed at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Without being saved or without.
Yeah, that's super hard to.
Yeah, so he just.
That's a super crazy coincidence.
Even if it is Lloyd, like, why would he just go in there, quickly type something, print it? You know what I mean?
Right.
And where would it feels like if that was the case, let's say that like he needed something for work real quick and he typed it out. It seems like he would like put it on the table, like the kitchen table or something, so he wouldn't forget it.
Right. Something that you're not going to save. Yeah. And if, yeah, it's something you're going to want to have it in a place where you could retrieve it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You made it really quick and you're taking it with you or you're doing something with it. It wouldn't be buried under anything. It would be out. And
yeah. It seems like it. I don't know.
That's crazy. Cause like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of stuff in this case is like leaning me towards innocence, but that fact right there should definitely not be glossed over.
Yeah,
like,
that's a tough one.
That's tough.
Yeah. No, that's where I'm at with it. Honestly, like I don't even know anymore. Like,
I know.
There's so much that does say that she's innocent, but like that particular thing right now is like the big holdup of like how is this not something? You know what I mean? Like, where is it? It's got to be somewhere.
Right. I almost want to look at like the crime scene photos again. But that the computer is in evidence still, right? Like they can.
I would guess so.
I would think so. Yeah, they can. I don't know, dude. That's a real hard coincidence to get past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that on the morning they die, hours before they die, there's a strange, weird document opened and printed and not saved and not and then not found.
Right.
It's hard.
Dude, that's, yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like that one's just like, oh, I don't know. Like we need to figure that one out as quickly as possible, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
That might be our big break, I think. Once it's either going to be the break, like for us to be like, oh, yeah, okay, this is open and shut, or it's going to open a million doors.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. That sounded redundant.
But like Bob said, I mean, if it was printed there, it's almost certainly her.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
So what do we have to do to find that answer?
I mean, there's got to be some other explanation. You know, I like they said, like with that there's almost like a fingerprint when they print.
See, I remember he said that, and like I brought that up a few months ago, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to remember if that was fact or if that was in like a CSI episode.
Yeah,
like I can't remember because I remember distinctly hearing that somewhere that there was some sort of ink, almost like a fingerprint ink mark, mm-hmm. that every printer puts on a piece of paper, like a small little signature. That's usually, I don't know how small it is. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. I'm looking at this piece of paper right here, and nothing looks out of the ordinary.
But there's got to be things that could trigger. You know, I, and maybe not every printer does it, but like
Like flaws in the letters?
Yeah, like a flaw in the letter, or like our printer at work, for whatever reason, and this is just a weird thing, but like it'll smudge like one line, but it's always like way down here, but it'll smudge part of it for whatever reason.
Right.
On every page, there's like a smudge like three quarters of the way down the line. That, you know what I'm saying? Like it, maybe there's some thing that does.
Right.
Actually, there was some good discussion in there while you were gone, because Mike and I even talked about, you know, the coincidence of the timing of that note and where it could be, and if it was Lloyd, let's say he printed out something that was important, it seems like it would be set in a place that he wouldn't forget it.
Right. You know, I wonder if it and sorry everybody, I had to step out for a minute until the guys continued on without me, which is fine. I was listening from the other side of the door, so I didn't want to interrupt you. I wonder if it doesn't have something to do, if it was Lloyd, if it doesn't have something to do with the tree work or the concerts or something, like he, you know, did he have to type something out that said, you know, Deb's going to approve the trees or.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Deb's never said that to my knowledge. So I doubt it, but it's just racking my brain and you can't not consider that. It was the murder, the leg note. But man, it's just hard to, it's hard to wrap my brain around her sitting down and typing that out before the murders.
Yeah.
You know, because if you think of like, it was premeditated, maybe. Well, so let's say her plan was to kill them. She knows that after she kills them, she'll have all the time in the world to sit down and write that note. Why sit down and do it when her mom's not even home? The note's perplexing, because in my opinion, it's hard to really theorize either way.
Yeah.
A scenario that makes a lot of sense.
My biggest thing is I hate coincidences.
Right.
I hate that on the morning they died, you know, an hour to 2 to 3 hours before they died, a quick note was opened, printed, not saved.
Right.
And we don't know where it is. That doesn't mean that it was. That doesn't mean anything. You know, right. Like you said, it could have been a note, and Deb took it with her to say, I approve these trees. But it's just strange to me that, like, let's say if it was Lloyd and it was something he needed for work, that it was a quick thing.
Yeah.
I feel like if I print something out that I need to set it somewhere.
Well, for all we know, it was in his pocket.
It could have been.
You know, that's the problem. There's so many holes, but I'm with you. The coincidence. I mean, that's why Deb was convicted. Was because of coincidences. Either because of coincidences or because there's all these little trails of circumstantial evidence that lead to her. You know, the cuts on her finger. It's either a coincidence that she cut her finger in blood on the scene, or she did it because, you know, that happened because she killed him. She would be very unlucky if she didn't kill her parents. That these things all kind of pointed back to her. It's just unfortunate that a thorough enough investigation wasn't done to answer these questions. I just feel like, if that note was printed on that printer, I feel like they could have proved it.
Yeah.
Without question, they could have proved it. And the fact that they didn't is just, I don't know, it's bad. Like I said, there's other avenues they could have done it. So I think that is a very viable path to finding the truth here. Like Mike said earlier, kind of, you know, it's a bummer to think about. You know, it's discouraging, but to me, it's not. I mean, I don't have a dog in this fight. All I want to do is find the truth. And so if we can test that computer and it turns out that note, it was that note printed at 10:01 a.m. In my opinion, that pretty much, I mean, I'd be done with the case. I would report to you guys. Sounds like Deb's guilty. I can't see any, I don't know who else came in the house at 10, you know, an hour before the murders, while Lloyd was there and printed the note, and then what left, and then they came home and Agnes took a nap, and then that person came back. I mean, no, if that note was printed on the printer, then I think Deb did it. No questions asked. So to me, that's something that might be easier to do than some of the DNA testing, because we don't know how stuff was filled. And I think it could give us the answer. Unfortunately, the sad part about it is if we find out that note wasn't printed on the computer, that doesn't exonerate Deb. You know, it takes one more circumstantial element away from her case, but that doesn't, I mean, it gets tricky because she doesn't have a computer at home, but of course you can hypothesize, well, maybe she went down to the public library and typed up the note and printed it and put it in her pocket. I mean, who knows? But that's an avenue. I know we need to move on. We got a lot more questions, but the note thing's interesting. I don't know. The way I looked at it last week when I was researching, writing the episode, in my mind, it just seemed like there was too many hoops to jump through for that to be Deb to have written it. The more I thought about it, and people pointed more stuff out to me, like, well, you know, what if it's Agnes that changes the font? You know, because my immediate thought was, well, what Agnes printed her stuff with is the default for that computer.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if something's printed with a different font, it was probably a different computer.
And could be, but like I said, that we see one document that has that font.
Right.
Yep. We don't know that that is the default font. It could have been an accident.
Yeah. And I'm hoping, you know, if we can, I know for sure next week I'm getting into the district clerk's office, so I'll have some more information. Still working on trying to get into the PD, you know, in the pandemic stuff, but I'm hoping we'll be able to find them. I'm hoping they took more pictures that we don't. They had to have taken more pictures. Well, we know for a fact there were things that were referenced at trial that he took photos of that we don't have the photos of. So hopefully we'll get some more information on that. But for now, let's go ahead and move on to the next question.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Sarah has two questions. Her first question is, in your experience, what are the reasons for an investigation to jump almost immediately into a suspect-driven investigation? Which of those reasons do you see present in the Courtney investigation?
Usually it has to do with tunnel vision, and it's usually a legitimate reason, which it is in this case, in my opinion. So, you know, whether Deb's innocent or guilty, what happened was Hardy saw the cuts on her fingers, knew she was there, and in my opinion, thinks she didn't, and I'm using air quotes, act right when they went to inform her of her parents' death and interviewed her, which could be because due to her mental conditions and her medications that she was on. But so he had legitimate reasons to suspect her, and I think that just jumped him into, she must do it. And in this case, I think it might be that, you know, a motivation to, you know, this was another cop. And they're highly motivated to solve this case and bring his killer to justice. And, you know, because of that, he might have, you know, just taken that first lead, assume she did it, and just be the type of person that just once he locks his brain into something, just can't come off it. And again, he might have got the right person, but there's no question throughout this investigation that it was 100% suspect driven, and they weren't looking at any other leads. They were only looking at Depp.
Her next question is, when did the police release the Courtney house, and who had access to it after it was released?
That's a good question. Something I didn't have time to cover in this week's episode. I don't know the date it was released, but I know it was well before the trash can lid was found. So that was July 23rd when Brenda's attorney's wife found the trash can lid. 2 months later, or 2 months earlier, in May, Brenda's attorneys were in the house again and contacted Detective Hardy or one of the police officers to let him know that things had been moved in the house. So remember, this is 2 months before they found the trash can lid. They went in, and these are all in the handwritten notes, that they went in and everything was like stacked up by the front door or something like that. And they wanted to know who was there. And as it turned out, the locksmith that had went in and changed the locks had gone in and moved a bunch of shit around because it sounds like, if I was reading it right, he was going to buy the house. And so he was moving stuff around. So again, as far as that evidence that was found there afterwards, you know, there was her attorneys. I think Deb and Brenda had been in the house. There was a note that Deb had called Brenda and said, when she goes to the house, she wants to go with her. The locksmith had been in the house. The attorney, the attorney's wife, things had been moved around all before that trash can lid was found.
Lauren says, is there any record of where the garbage can lid was between the initial crime scene and when it was brought in for evidence testing 8 months later?
No, we don't have that information. I've been told by Judge Dauphineau that it was Brenda's attorneys that found it. She said under a bed in the back bedroom, but that's just anecdote. I mean, I don't have any evidence to support that. But I will point out that it was a couple months later when I was reading the report that sure enough, it actually was her attorneys that found it. And it was not the police. as far as found the blood spot on it. Which, can we talk about that for a second? What do you think about the fact that three trained crime scene investigators, or multiple trained crime scene investigators, looked at that lid and said there was nothing on it, and then 8 months later, the attorney's wife looks at it and says, "Oh, look, there's blood," and it was blood.
It's really strange to me. I mean, that's one of the big hangups for me is that particular spot of blood, because the photographs, I mean, it's clear. The photographs that I believe I've seen of it, it's pretty clear that there's a blood spot on it.
About the size of it. And I'm trying to find it again. It was buried in a file somewhere. I've shown it to you, but yeah. I was going to upload it to the site and I couldn't find where I put it. So yeah, hopefully that, along with some testimony, is going to get added to the episode 9 folder.
But it just doesn't, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that that's something.
It's like the size of a fingerprint.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know how they just bypassed that and decided that wasn't worth looking at.
Not only just bypassed it, but specifically said they all looked at it to see if there was anything on it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they just completely bypassed it. You know, in the Melgar case, when they found the blood on the safe, they just said, "Oh, it's Jamie's," and they didn't test it.
Right.
But like this, they're just totally ignoring the fact that it was there, or it really wasn't there when they saw it.
Yeah. Well, in my opinion, it's pretty clear that it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't see it or said they had a reason not. They said they looked at the lid. He brought in other CSIs to examine it, and they all determined there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I start to, again, go back to the having some real problems with the investigation, because, you know, in my opinion, if anything dishonest and inappropriate is done during the investigation, if there's corruption within the investigation, then the entire investigation is corrupt, in my opinion. So if we look at that, if you look at that trash can lid that had nothing on it, 8 months later, oh, look, there's a big blood spot on there and it happens to be Deborah's. That's super suspicious. And if something was done like you know, that evidence was planted or anything like that, well, then now you can't believe anything in the case. If the police department is willing to do that, then you can't trust anything. I'm not saying that happened, but it sure as hell is pretty suspicious.
Well, and it could lead back that it was Deborah's, but down the road. Maybe she went back over there to clean and got blood on it. And then they turned it in and they said, oh, they swab it and it really is Deborah's.
Mm-hmm.
And they just didn't want to buy her excuse that it was from a later time.
Right.
Shannon says, have you reached out to Christina Glenn, a lawyer in Fort Worth? The name Christina Glenn shows up on a document file name on the computer forensics and was accessed in the month prior to the murders. She specializes in family law, estates, probate, etc. I wonder if there's a way to figure out what she was working on with the Courtneys.
Well, they won't. An attorney can't share that information with me, but I was interested when I found that, because another thing that Judge Dauphineau, who again was very, very close with her aunt, Agnes, told me when I first started speaking with her about the case, was that due to the estranged, probably isn't the right word, but the relationship with Brenda, how she had just kind of stopped coming around, like they would see her maybe at a holiday or a birthday or something, but just wasn't involved in the Courtney's life anymore. She told me that the Courtney's had been meeting with an estate attorney and they were redoing their will, and that the plan was to write Brenda out of the will.
Oh, that's a really interesting find. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, and I've hesitated to bring it up because, you know, there's a lot of things that Judge Dauphineau has told me, but I don't want to just put stuff out there if there's nothing to back it up with. Not you know, I'm sure everything she's saying is true and accurate to the best of her knowledge, but I need to have evidence backing it up. And in this case, now I see that, okay, they were meeting and had contact with an estate attorney, which seems to corroborate what Judge Dauphineau had told me, that it sounds like they were going to write her out of the will. Also, did you notice there was another note? You probably didn't go through the documents. I didn't bring it up in the episode, but there's in the handwritten notes, they had, Hardy had spoken with Billy Ray Sinkafield, the nephew, and they asked him if, and maybe it was in the report and I just don't remember it, but I remember it jumped out at me this time, that they said, you know, who do they think could have hurt them? And they seemed to be questioning him from the notes about if it was a family member. And he said, he thinks that if any family member would have done this to them, it would have been Brenda.
Hmm. Which is interesting.
Which doesn't mean anything more than Brenda saying she thinks it was Deb. But if, you know, if that's out there, then I think that should be out there too.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Okay, and her follow-up to that is, do you have a copy of the Courtney's will?
I don't, but hopefully that'll be something that, if it was entered into evidence at trial, then we should be able to get a hold of it next week at the clerk's office. Because what we don't have is, we don't have any of the the exhibits from trial. They were never turned over to us in our open records request, which I have I've requested from police department and the DA's office, and IPTX already had stuff from the clerk's office as far as the trial transcripts and stuff. So I don't know if anybody's ever requested it, but that's one thing we're going to go look at, get copies of, are the actual exhibits from trial.
Tiffany says, have you reached out to Brenda at all to confirm her comments and to see why she was so quick to point the finger at Deb?
No, I haven't, for a couple of reasons. One, the same reason I hadn't reached out to Deb until now is because I didn't even know which questions to ask yet, because I had a lot more, you know, we needed to do a lot of digging to know, to have a better picture of the case before we start asking questions. And again, I have finally written to Deb now, so we should start getting some of those answers. And also, just from my understanding, she has no desire to speak with any media whatsoever. That's what I've been told. And if you look at the media on the cases, between newspaper articles, TV news reports, the episode of Snap, these, you don't see Brenda appearing or speaking in any of those. So it's just not something I've dedicated a lot of time to yet.
Solomon says, was a copy of the surveillance video from Target ever provided to the defense, and or did the detective ever have a copy of it?
No, it was never turned over to the defense, and we don't know. I mean, according to the report, Hardy never got a copy of it. He never documented that he did get a copy of it. If he did get a copy of it, then Fort Worth PD, I guess, would be in violation of the Open Records Act or FOIA because they didn't turn it over to me. But that's some of the things that we're trying to find out when we get to Texas, when we actually get our hands on the files.
All right. And I pulled this from an email from listener Heather. I find it really fascinating, and I think it really works towards how beneficial our crowdsourcing model is for the podcast. She writes, I've trained in handwriting transcription for about 8 years, mostly old English and records from the past few centuries. I thought I would look at the words you mentioned during your most recent podcast to see if I can lend a hand. In handwriting transcription, one of the most important tools is comparing the letter in question with words that are already known in the document being transcribed. If you look at the word evidence, two lines below the word in question, the two D's appear to match. Further, if you look through the rest of his notes, you will see that the D's are fairly consistent in the odd way in which he writes it. Comparing it to a lowercase j was more difficult, as I could only find a few examples of a lowercase j. For examples, on page 7 he writes the word just, in which the J looks like a proper lowercase J. Also at the bottom of the page in the margin, he writes the word injuries, with the J looking like the one in just. I am fairly confident to say that the letter that begins the word is a D, as his D's are fairly consistent throughout the notes. I think that the word is a misspelling of the word do, D-O, and instead he wrote do, D-U-E. What do you take away from this, Bob?
I think Heather's exactly right, and several other listeners, much less detailed, had come to the same conclusion. And actually, I kind of came to that same conclusion, too. So to be clear, what we're talking about is in the notation, the handwritten notation about the DNA evidence, it says Carla cannot blank the DNA evidence at this time. And when I read it as do, as though it was misspelled. So D-U-E, which should be do, which is what she said here. But my thought was, I didn't go through that thorough of an analysis. It just looked like maybe that's a D, maybe a U, maybe an E. And I thought, well, is my brain just doing that because that's the word I expect to be there? And so I just said what they looked like because I didn't want to put my thoughts into anybody's mind when you guys all started digging into this. And everybody seemed to come to the same conclusion based on a very thorough handwriting analysis that it looks like what he wrote was Carla cannot do this DNA testing at this time. And he spelled do wrong. He spelled it D-U-E instead of D-O. So that was a good catch. That's a very, very detailed analysis. And I think that we can kind of put that one into bed because you can go letter by letter and see what those letters were. Weird misspelling, but I guess that's what happened.
All right, that's it for questions this week. Thanks, everybody, for writing in.
Yep, thanks, everybody. Sorry, I don't know how Mike's going to edit this thing together. We had a few interruptions. I had to step out of the room. There's an internet repairman outside drilling holes in the walls while we're recording. So hopefully Mike gets all this cut together. Thank you guys for being patient and putting up with us. And make sure you tune in on Sunday and the day after that. I'm leaving for Texas. And hopefully for next week, we'll have some new information for you. And for this Sunday, we have a special guest. I was actually able to reach out and get a hold of and interview Dr. Margarita Avalos. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 per month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. And like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING. And Zach can be found at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
This has been Truth and Justice. Just figure out a spot to clean that up, Mike. Good luck on this one.
Just say right.
Right.
That's all I needed.
I didn't remember what he said.
So it's fine. Shannon says,
can I give you a better right? I don't know if I'm happy with that right.
Yeah, just more agreeance.
Yeah. Right.
That's dude, that was like almost identical.
No, last time I was like, right. And this time I was like, right.
You could give
there's
me
our
the,
bloopers
you
right
could give
there.
Me like the sarcastic one. You can give me the sarcastic, right?
We're
like,
right.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.